Folks, you know I bring the heavy hitters in. This person I've come on the show is doing so many amazing things. You know they say good things are for those who wait. And guess what? I had to wait. I wanted to wait for her because, you know what? She's a powerhouse. And you might not know who she is, but you're going to know who she is if you don't know right now after this episode. The next voice you hear is Ms. Jada McCray.
We made a pledge to do what's best for the health of our communities. And we continue to deliver on it every day. For every one of our members. With access to a network of over 1 million providers, rewards for living healthy, and more care options than ever, we are CareFirst Blue Cross Blue Shield, and we are changing healthcare for all that we serve. At CareFirst, it's not just our name, it's our promise.
Welcome to the No Picks of a Dark podcast. I'm your host, Aaron Dante. I told you. I got the heavy hitters in Baltimore and all abroad to come here and hang out in the studio. This person, she is doing so many great things. I'm so excited to have her on this show. I'm over here like fangirl, like, oh my God, I can't be ever having an episode. Ms. Jada McCray, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for hanging out at the studio, hanging out for a little bit.
Thank you.
But I want to make sure I give it the props before we start. Ms. Jada McCray is the CEO of PTSD and owner and owner of Black Swan and also an investor with you and your husband. I know. Did I miss anything?
No. There's a couple things here and there.
All right, see, I want to give you a flower. I wanted to give the flower, so I apologize if I missed anything.
No, really it's okay. It's okay.
So what's going on? Like, I mean, you are doing so many great things out here. Where do we start? Are you originally from Maryland?
I'm from Baltimore, born and raised, and I tell anybody, if you don't know, the minute you hear me speak, you find out that I'm from Baltimore.
You sound real strong.
Oh, yeah. Baltimore. I'm from Baltimore. I'm serious about it. East Baltimore, to be exact. I was born in West Baltimore, but I grew up in East Baltimore. So, yeah, I love this place.
Got you. Got you. So, where'd you go to high school in there? Because, you know, that's, I always ask about the Baltimore thing. Where'd
that's
you go
the question.
To high school?
I'm a Western Dove. I went to Western.
Yeah. Okay.
You couldn't tell?
Hey, I don't assume anymore. I don't assume anymore. You know, I just tell people, where you go? I ain't going. So, you went to Western, which is a great all-girl school. One of the oldest ones around.
Yes.
One of the oldest ones around. And during that time period, did you have family members that were entrepreneurs? Did you see any entrepreneurs growing up?
No, not one. Okay. So a little bit about me, my family, I grew up in Baltimore. I'm an Army brat. And when I was about 4 or 5 years old, my father joined the Army and we moved away. We lived in Oklahoma. We lived in North Carolina. And by the time we came back to Baltimore, we left Baltimore and it was one place. We lived in McCullough Homes. When we came back, I always liken it to what you see on the wire. So by the time we came back, it was very wire-ish in Baltimore. And during the visit, like when we would come back to visit family and stuff, family has a way of making you feel warm and happy and welcoming. So you don't necessarily look at the external, look at the environment. When we came back, it was a culture shock. So I went from living on an Army base, which is one of the safest places you can ever live in our country, to living in Baltimore. And it was just so... It was shocking to me as a little girl to come back here and see what Baltimore had become at that time. It was right after, it was 1990 when we came back. And so we were in the middle of the crack epidemic and heroin epidemic in Baltimore. And the shine and veneer that I'd seen in Baltimore from the beginning had faded almost it seemed abrupt. The crash seemed abrupt.
Wow, that's a lot. Mm-hmm. Where did you guys live in the military? Around the world? Did you guys are in the States? Did you guys travel?
We stayed in the States. My dad had gone. He went to Korea for a year in, like, I think 86, 87. And then we came back here in 1990. So I was like 9 and a half. It was the end of my fourth grade year. I remember that.
So you went from a base to a culture shock, a real culture shock.
Yes.
What was one of the motivating factors for you to, like I'm going to see, I'm going to make this happen. I want to make sure that I'm better for me, something like that.
So one of the things that I'd seen both sides of it. So this is to be very, so not everything is perfect in a military base. And we had a lot of interesting dynamics in my family at the time as well, too. You know, we had, my parents were really young when they had us. And so they were trying to figure themselves out as adults as well, too. My mom is still, she and I are very extraordinarily close, but my dad had a set of issues that were complicated matters in our family. And so I don't want to make it seem like all life was sweet. It was a little, you know, we have our life just like everybody else.
Right.
We came back to Baltimore, but we'd had a pretty stable middle class life in the Army. We came back to Baltimore, and by the time I was going on 10. By the time I was 12, we now lived off of Greenmount Avenue. It was my mother, my sister, and I. My parents had separated and were divorced. My father, again, who has his own struggles, was outside of the house by then. And so I remember we went from living a comfortable lifestyle to living pretty much in poverty. There's really no other way to describe it. My mother always takes umbrage when I say that, like, oh, I took care of y'all. She did. And she worked two jobs and she did a lot. But there's something to be said about living in poverty, and it was rough. And I remember thinking to myself, like, what did we do for us to deserve this? So we've gone from living comfortably. That's the thing about capitalism in America. It doesn't necessarily speak to your virtue and your character as people, but poverty makes you feel shame. As if you've done something wrong to end up in the situation that you're in. And not just life in, because that's what happens. And people experience all kinds of circumstances. But I remember that feeling, and I remember thinking, it can't end this way. And much to my mother's credit, it took her about 10 years. So from the time I was 11, 12-ish until I was about 22, she worked, she saved. By the time I was 22, she purchased her own house. She had a car. But there were so many things that there's a strain and stress that comes with poverty. And so I always talk about me, my sister, and my mother. We're like, you know how people talk about people they go to war with? They're at war. We were like comrades at arms. And so we worked through that together. But it was a lot to get there as well, too. So when you're strained and there's not enough to go around, it strains the dynamics in the family. Mm-hmm. And not to just mention, but also the divorce and substance abuse issues, again, with my father, and mental health issues. And all of those things put a great strain on the family. And so we were rebuilding from rubble. So you know how they say, like, when a nuclear blast happens, that everything is decimated, and then after thousands of years, you start seeing greenery again?
Right.
It was like we were the greenery coming up after those thousands of years. That's what it felt like anyway.
Now, you said a little bit, tidbit about the mental health. Did that influence you a little bit for later on in life, just seeing mental health with your issues with your father? Did that kind of influence you a little bit, maybe?
I don't see how it couldn't have.
Okay.
I remember... So for myself, I've also had issues with anxiety, but also if you may not know this, but when people grow up in domestic violence relationships, domestic violence situations, it literally alters your central nervous system. And so you become hypervigilant. You're constantly on watch, and you learn how to read a room as soon as you walk through the door. Like I walk through the door, I can tell you what's going on with everybody.
Oh, wow.
As soon as I hit the door, I know this, I can read it all. As soon as I get there, I can read situations and people and all of those things. But a lot of that comes from that. So sometimes you have to, things that come out of those things are not always weaknesses. Right. Sometimes those are things that you have to embrace because these are now your survival instincts, things that happen. Now, what I will say is, and my cousins will say this too, don't sneak up behind me. Because if you sneak up behind me.
All right, we ain't going to do that. We're not going to do that. You know? We make sure the door lock. We good. Nobody's coming through. But
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
But that's one of those things where I'd experience anxiety. And again, when you grow up in a situation like that, there's depression. It's a heaviness that falls on the house. So don't get me wrong. We had a lot of fun together, a lot of laughter. My mother makes holidays amazing, all of those things. But there's always a heaviness that comes with that. And when you grow up that way, whether your parents try to shield you from it or not, their children know. And there's a certain sense of responsibility that comes with that as well. I have to manage myself. I have to make sure that I'm in control of me, that I'm not upsetting a situation or making a situation worse and all of those things. So you also learn how to suppress emotion as well. So by the time I got into college, I was ready to, I was going to school for nursing, and I had a breakup with somebody, and I was, you know, crying and falling apart, and I was missing exams. And my friend said, well, have you ever thought about being a social worker?
Right.
And I was like, what is a social worker?
Right.
And she explained to me what it is, and it was about helping people in tough situations. And I was like, I could do that. I did that for myself. I know exactly how to do that.
Right.
And so it felt like a natural fit for me.
It's funny, my mom is a social worker. And so it was always interesting because she worked in hospitals.
Okay.
She worked in high school. So we traveled also. So we traveled. Born in Baltimore, lived in Ohio, lived in Dallas, Texas, lived in New York, back to Houston, Texas. So we had moved all over. And I remember growing up, my mom would be like, you will not have any kids at all. And she would always be like, you see this picture of this right here? Do you want this? Or any STDs. So do you see this ugly thing? And that was my mom being such where like, this is how the real world looks. Yeah. And it was it was her scare street. Yeah. And trust me, I didn't have kids until later on.
Yeah.
And so it was like, definitely, you know, I always have a warm spot with social workers because I know what you guys have gone through and go through every day. And it's not an easy job.
Yeah.
And we lean a lot more. So where'd you end up going to college?
So I went to Coppin State College. I absolutely, I love Coppin because I feel like Coppin was my first second chance.
Okay.
By the time I was in high school, I was kind of not really interested in, I feel like high school, and to this day, I still feel that way. It's 2 years too long.
Facts. It is.
You had me taking all of these electives and stuff. I was ready to get out in the real world. And again, my mother was struggling. She was working really hard. And I felt like I could really just be working. I could be going somewhere else and I could be, I've been working since I was 14. Wow. But I thought to myself, like, I really want to contribute. I really feel like I need to get life going. And I feel like this is just holding me in place. And so I wasn't interested. I was one of those people where I did well just because I'm really good at absorbing information. I'm a really good test taker. But to say that I was interested would be a lie. And so by the time it came around for me to go to college, I took my SATs and I did very well on my SATs. And I remember my school counselor said, you can score this on your SATs, but you're getting C's in school. And I'm like, because I don't care. Right. I have other things on my mind. I don't have time to play. And this is, for me, it was like, you're holding me up from doing what I need to do. And so Coppin was great. I went to a school fair, and they saw my SAT scores and they gave me a scholarship, a full ride.
Wow.
And so I said, okay, might as well.
Now, did you finish Coppin early? Did you get that done quickly? Or did you just...
No, I went 4 years at Coppin, and I'm glad that I did.
Okay.
And part of that was because I changed my major. So after I changed my major, I had to do like 18 credits a semester, and then winter session and all of that stuff. And so I'm glad I did because I met my husband then.
Okay.
Yeah, he also went to Coppin.
Yeah, I was on a 4-year plan. That's all I could do. It was like, they were like, you got 4 years for yourself. After that, you on your own. And trust, I took a couple summer courses too, like, I was like, I gotta get out. There's no other way. So you get that, and then your major. So what was your major when you first? So your major was nursing, and then you switched over to social work.
Social work. Yeah.
So how much? What did does that overlap a little bit in the beginning? Like for like electives, pretty much you have to take the same sociology class, psych classes.
Yeah. Like a lot of those things did overlap. It felt like social work for me felt like a more natural fit.
Right.
So I feel like nursing was one of those things where people were like, oh, you're smart, you want to help people, you should go into nursing.
Right.
And so I did well in the nursing program until I had that little breakup, and I'm so grateful for that breakup. But And then I started like flunking my exams, and I didn't have the interest, but social work for me felt like a natural fit. So as soon as I began taking social work classes, it almost felt as easy as breathing. Mm. It felt like, this is who I am. This is what I'm supposed to do. And the time just zipped by after that.
I love it. So what was your first job out of college? Who was the first? Do you remember that?
Yes. I went on to get my master's degree at the University of Maryland. And I had to work at the Baltimore County Department of Social Services for 2 years to, again, get school paid for.
Mm.
And I was a child protective service worker.
Oh, wow.
And that left such a tremendous impact on me. It was one of the hardest and most beautiful experiences I ever had in my life. And it grew my compassion for people 1,000-fold. I realized there were people in situations that were very much like my situation was. People had fallen on hard times, or people who had, you know, and didn't really have the wherewithal, or people who were just trying to make it. Now, there were some people who were just truly neglectful and abusive towards their children. But what I can tell you is that was rare. It was rare for us to encounter people who were just just sadistic and mean and wanted to harm children. Oftentimes, it was people who were doing the best that they could and falling short.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So that, I mean, I can only imagine you learned a lot.
I learned
an extraordinary amount. It was a whole different end. Mm-hmm. From that standpoint, after that, was like, did you want to stay in that realm or did you want to go into mental health? Like, what was your realm? Tell us a little bit of the journey.
So the funny thing is I got my license to be a clinician, and I started doing that part-time to pay for my wedding. And I realized I would always keep my cases way too long in social work. And Jane Gehring, who was our program director at the time, said, Jada, you are really great at this, and you have the heart for helping people, but you keep your cases way too long. And it was obviously because I wanted to make sure that I put I always felt like if we could just put certain services in place, because what happens is for you to be referred to Child Protective Services, if this is baseline, then somewhere along the line, you've dipped below baseline. Mm-hmm. And then a Child Protective Service worker is going to come in and say, well, now you need to come above baseline if you want to keep your children. But if I'm already down here, if I'm this far down, how exactly am I supposed to get up without assistance or help? And so I always felt like we needed to do more. I needed to put enough programs in place, enough services in place to disrupt the cycle of dysfunction, to really support people. Because again, most people are well-meaning and just don't have the means or the tools to get them back to baseline and above so that they could keep their children. Because the goal was never to break families apart ever.
Right.
So I would always keep my cases far too long. So just the nature of being a social worker, you may have 50 cases. And I always let people know it's not 50 children, it's 50 families. Right. So everything attached to that one person, that one social security number, you are responsible. So if anything else falls apart, you're responsible for every person connected to that household and in that family. And so it also becomes, and shout out to Child Protective Service workers all over this country, because it's a lot to manage. And for me, I think I was maybe, I was 26 at the time.
Right.
So I'm really learning how to manage myself.
Right.
You know, and not to mention my pay was so little, I used to go to the library for fun.
That's a new one.
So, thank God I love to read, because I'm telling you, I didn't have any money left over after I paid my bills. And so it's a lot to ask. And you have to be, I would say social workers are born. You can't get into this profession because you want to make money, or, you know, you think it's a cushion. I don't know. I don't know why people would get in it other than because you have a genuine love and care for people and compassion for people.
I love it. I love it. So I'm glad you get the audience a little quick background. When we come back after these messages, we're going to talk about how she got into all her endeavors, because we want to know, I mean, she is doing so many amazing things that we want to salute and highlight what you got going on, because it's very important. The one thing I want to tell about this podcast is telling the stories of people you may know, but you like, I've seen them, but let's learn a little bit more about them and who they are. So folks, we'll be right back after these messages.
Give to United Way. Your gift could be the first spark of something bigger. It can help someone find, interview for, and get hired for a job, and provide follow-up services for success. It can break down educational barriers and give that extra help to a struggling student with in-school support programs. Give today. Spark something bigger.
Are you or someone you love in need of mental health support? For All Seasons is now offering same-day therapy appointments with no wait list. Through the For All Seasons Open Access Program, you can walk in for mental health services and begin therapy in the same visit. For All Seasons accepts all insurances and provides financial assistance if you need it. For therapy, psychiatry, or victim support, we have appointments available today. Call For All Seasons, 410-822-1018.
All right, folks, we are back. Thank you so much, Ms. Jada. This has been amazing. I mean, you're breaking down so many barriers and telling so many great stories. Thank you so much for sharing your story. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm learning, you know, sitting here like, oh, wow, that's real stuff. So tell us about your company, one of the companies, the BTST
Services. I know.
I'm sorry.
I didn't come up with the name. My business partner, founder of BTST Services, Chris Tyler, came up with the name.
I'm sorry.
And once you get past fumbling the letters, it's a better tomorrow starts today.
Correct.
And I think that's just so profound, because that's the decision has to be made today for changes to occur tomorrow. And so I fell in love with the name. People call us PTSD. I'm like, please don't call us that.
No, you ain't PTSD. No, you got some lovely office on North Avenue. That's in the heart of the city.
Yes.
And I'm sure that was on purpose for a reason why.
Yes.
Let's get into that. Let's talk about how you and Chris met. Chris was as a friend of the show. He's been a couple times. Mm-hmm. Tell us how you guys got involved and on your end of the stories.
So I went from Child Protective Services. I told you about that. I became a clinician and just absolutely loved mental health services. So what happens with anything that you love that you're naturally good at is that you get promoted out of it, honestly. Mm-hmm. And so I became a supervisor. I loved doing that, just pouring into newer therapists and helping them to understand and explore and understand treatment. And then I became a director, and then I started helping people to build clinics. So I was director of program development for a prominent mental health agency in our area, just continuing to build, and just knew everything about mental health clinics from the rooter to the tutor. So I was out part of what I was tasked to do with my job there is to tell people about the services that we provide. And so I was doing that, and I ran into Chris Simon. He'd gone and talked before me, but something that day just made him wait around for me. And he was like, wait a minute, can I talk to you for a minute? I was like, listen, I got to go pick up my kids. Because if anybody know me, they know I don't play about my kids. Right. I'm like, I got to go pick up my kids. You can talk to me in this elevator. And so he gave me, I'd say that's the elevator ride that changed my life. And we began to build a relationship from there. And the place where I was with the people, they kind of didn't want to, they wanted to utilize him to get into an area, but they didn't have the best, and I don't want to say anything bad about people, but they didn't have the, I'd say they didn't necessarily have his best interest at heart with that. Okay. And I said, anybody, you talk to me for 5 minutes, you know I'm a Christian. And so some things you just don't do. Right. And I felt really uncomfortable with that. And I told him, I said, you know, I don't necessarily believe they have your best interest at heart with this. And maybe you should go in a different direction. And because of that, it we grew a relationship from there. And I said, well, why don't you, you know, he had a supplementary program at the time, a PRP, which is a psychiatric rehabilitation program. And I said, why don't you build your own clinic? So that way you're not relying on other people's referrals and you can be self-sustaining. And he said, he was like, well, I like what I do and blah, 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 blah. I'm fine at the level that I'm at. And I was like, okay. He said, well, why don't you build your own? I said, I have two small children and my job right now, I said, you know, I'm at this point a six-figure social worker, which was a rarity in our field at the time. And I was like, and I have two small children. And so I don't know if I would have the time or the capacity to do it. But, little did he know at the time that me and God had already had a conversation and God told me I would have my own clinic one day. Mm. And I was like, you know, sometimes when you're tasked with things that you feel are beyond what you have the capacity for, you're like, no, God, I don't know. You ain't talking to me, even though it's just me and you in the kitchen. And so I'd already kind of known that that's the route that was going to happen one day. I just didn't understand the roadmap to get there. So again, we began to build a relationship and he called one day and he said, Jada, I'm going to build a clinic. I think he was like, would you be my partner? Mm. And I said, I was sick to my stomach, but I gave an absolute yes. Mm. And I said, I sure will. And then it just took off from there. It took off like a rocket. I don't know if, you know, if God was waiting for us to get together, for it to just be a rocket fuel situation and things just to take off. And we started getting referrals from everywhere. It was almost like everywhere I'd ever been and everywhere I'd ever worked and all the relationships that I made. They found out that we were starting a clinic and they flooded us. Mm. They flooded us right away. And people that I'd worked with at other agencies, they wanted to come and join and work there. And so it was almost like from the beginning, we had a full functioning clinic just right off the bat served up on a plate with us. Like, here, these are such and such number of therapists that, wow. I mean, literally walking through the door with this. And so it was just... it was amazing. I've never seen anything like that before. And that's why I always tell people, like, if God tells you that something's going to happen, you don't always have to know the plan. Because right. God knows the plan. He's like, you just got to get there. Just right. give me yes and get there.
Wow.
Yep.
That's correct. I remember he told me a little, but I like hearing mm-hmm. both variations of the story. You know, I always tell people, you know, you are where you're supposed to be at that moment.
Absolutely.
And it kind of felt like you were supposed to be in an elevator at yeah. that moment and talk yes. to each other. Mm-hmm. And how long have you guys been going, how long company been around for?
I've been at BTST for 8 years at this point. Okay. I think we met 9 years ago and I was there for, I've been there for about 8 years. And what's really interesting about that is that we've, I don't even know if it's triple, quadruple, what is single? We are 6 or 7 times bigger now than we were when we started. Wow. I mean, it was just absolutely insane. Wow. It was absolutely insane. I can't even put words to, It was meteoric. I always tell people, it's like you ever playing cards and you get a hot hand. Mm-hmm. I told Chris, I was like, this is our hot hand. This is the moment. This is the white hot moment that we have right now. Mm. And I think a lot of that is because there's a genuine compassion and concern for us to help people. You understand what yeah. I'm saying? I always feel like if your intentions are pure, you kind of don't have to worry about the result because things come out exactly the way they're supposed to.
I believe that. Mm-hmm. And that's how I live. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, I always tell people, I bring other people along, like, hey, you want to learn? Come along. Just mm-hmm. listen. I will give you a resource I have.
Yeah.
What am I taking to the grave with me? Mm-hmm. And I never understood that growing up, like when people were like, the old way of like, I'm not going to tell them secretly. What else am I going to do with it? I'm not going to share it and try to help people out and try to get to where they're going to want to get to and try to achieve their goals. So
I think in our community, and I know people always reference the crabs in a barrel mentality, and I get it. But I think in our community, we feel like, I always talk about, it's like the Highlander, like they can only be one. Do you remember that show
from the 80s? Right, I remember the Highlander. That was a wild show,
when they came across each other, they had to behead each other because they could only be one Highlander. And I think that for us, for Black people, we feel like there can only be one. And that's always been, I think... the greatest source of weakness that we've had in our community, because we've been socialized to believe that there can only be one, when our greatest strength is in partnerships. Right. And so if you can work with other people, information is far more valuable than money could ever be. So if you came to me and you said, Jada, can I have some money? And da 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 da. But I'm like, do you want money or do you want inside information? Because there's a game afoot that a lot of us don't even know is being played.
Can you say that one more time?
You know, can you say that? Information.
Like you're talking, but that's what I people don't understand. Like, I'm like, I'm bringing you into this room. The money is here. It's in the room. You just got to be in the room.
Listen.
Don't worry about who, how much I need. Just be in the room, and you never know who's going to be talking to. You never know who's going to be. And like I said, I'm very thankful for you and Chris, because you guys have been like inviting me to a lot of these great events. And it's just a blessing, because I'm like, I'm going to get to talk with so-and-so. I get to talk with so-and-so. Yeah. And it just... it's warming because you're accepting. Yeah. And so I always appreciate you guys for doing that. I really do.
We really want to share, and we really do want to spread it. And it's like, you have you ever seen Hamilton?
Yeah.
I want to be in the room where it happens. Yeah. you need to be in the room where it happens. You need to be around it and understand. My children, I'm never worried about it. You asked me, did I grow up in a home of entrepreneurship? I grew up in a home where my mother hustled.
Right.
She worked hard. She grinded. She hustled. So at a very early age, I started waiting tables, and I hustled. I knew how to, listen, I'm going to make a dollar holler one way or another. So, but my children, they growing up around entrepreneurs and people in government and this, that, and the third, and they have a different level of confidence when they move around a room. So for them, there's no imposter syndrome when they're entering into a room. They don't care who you are. They will look you in your eye, they will shake your hand, and they'll talk to you directly because they're used to
it.
A lot of us don't have that exposure. And so when you get there, you may have a drive, you may have ambition, but you don't have exposure. And so you tend to wilt inside of yourself. And a lot of times the people that we're afraid to approach, they can spot talent right away. They know what you are.
Right.
But do you know who you are?
And that's it right there. Mm-hmm. You said it right there. Mm-hmm. So you guys, but you guys are killing it out here right now.
Thank you.
Why North Avenue? What made you want to be headquarters North Avenue?
It's the heart of the city.
Okay.
It's the heart of the city. And one of the things I love the most about Baltimore is the people. It has such a bad reputation.
I love the people.
But Baltimore has a bad reputation, so everybody only sees, so everything is snapshots. So you only see what the media shows you. They show you, you know, there's drugs, there's crime, there's The Wire, homicide, life on the street. There's never any, everything about Baltimore, there's never a positive portrayal. Mm-hmm. People don't know that it's like, it's Baltimore. Like, everybody in Baltimore is your cousin.
Right.
You know what I mean? We have all of these, it's Charm City for a reason. We have all of these beautiful pockets of life happening all the time here. And I think that sometimes you just have to look beyond what's obvious and what's in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And for us, we were able to do that. We were like, North Avenue is the heart of the city.
It is.
And what's a beautiful place. And if we provided offsite therapy at the time before COVID happened. And so our therapists had to be able to shoot off everywhere from every city, every county, all of those things. So you got 83, you got 95, you have all of these major highways, and from North Avenue, you can get everywhere.
Right.
And so for us, that was really important. We could also bring people in from everywhere as well. But more than that, where we are located used to be an old Child Protective Services building.
Mm.
And so I think that it's a building for us. It's a building where so many people came to that they were at the worst time in their life, and they had to show up. Their court mandated to show up, and it could be the worst day of their life. And then to take that and turn it into, now we're here to help those who are in trouble, in need, and grieving and lost and depressed and anxious. And we're here to help.
Right.
So I think that sometimes you just have to reclaim a space.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love it. So how many employees do you have now? It's like, you guys, I know, because I know you guys are all over the place. You guys have, where are your offices at right now?
We have offices in Baltimore, Prince George's County, Washington County, and Frederick County in the state of Maryland.
Wow.
Yeah.
You guys are everywhere. All over. I love that. So we're talking about women in business.
Mm-hmm.
How does it feel to be one of the top, you are one of the biggest people in Maryland.
Oh, wow.
How's that feel? Because you were just on the panel the other day. And how does it feel to be called in these panels and being like known as like the woman to go to for business and being an entrepreneur and understanding how the things work out here and learning?
I think it's surreal. Okay. It's surreal because I'm still Jada from Baltimore, and she still has to pick up her children from school, and she still has to make dinner at night, and I'm still somebody's wife, and I'm still somebody's daughter and sister. And so for me, I think that's the most grounding part of it all. And it helps me to never lose sight of my responsibility, because it's bigger than me. And I always know that, you know, God will take the least of these and make them great. He'll make your name great. And so I'm always very cognizant of that. And if you don't mind me getting a little churchy for a minute, exactly. I always think that, you know, God took David, who was a shepherd boy, and made him the king of Israel. Mm-hmm. So it's not always who other people are expecting, because God doesn't ask anybody for permission. Mm. He decides what your fate is. And if you say yes, then he'll put you where he wants you to be. And so for me, I never take it for granted, and I never think more highly of myself than I ought. I am a proponent of servant leadership. And so with more responsibility, the bigger these organizations get, the more money that we make, the more I feel that it's necessary to do it well, because there are a lot of people who are, you know, who are responsible, and I have to make sure I'm responsible for a lot of people. And I think at BTST, we have almost 300 employees, and we provided services last year for 6,748 clients. And so at night when I go to sleep, I think I have almost 300 employees, and those are 300 families. It doesn't change my from when I was a child protective services worker. 300 employees with 300 families that they're attached to, and 7,648 people who, if given appropriate intervention, clinical care, and healing, can change 7,648 generations. You understand what
you
I'm saying?
You got a lot of numbers there.
Yeah.
But I understand what you're saying, though.
But you know.
It affects everybody.
Yeah.
And I like that you care so much about what you got going on.
Well, it's more humbling than it will ever make me feel grandiose. It's okay. Humbling.
Now, how do you feel as just a Black woman now doing your thing? Like, you're in the forefront. People come to you now and ask you, and you're a mentor. You mentor young women. How does that feel?
Well,
from where you've come from to where you are right now?
I had to throw off imposter syndrome first.
Okay.
I had to let that go. And I realized that there's a need for whatever it is that's here on the earth. I was created for a purpose. Mm-hmm. And so there's a need for me to fulfill here on earth. And so if I'm in a boardroom, if I'm at a table, it's because I'm supposed to be there. Mm-hmm. And I'm not there to conform, and I'm not there to be... To make myself smaller. Whatever my experiences are, whatever my, you know, my educational background, my experiential background, whatever it is needed in that room. And so a lot of times when people are making decisions that impact thousands and millions of people, you need to be there to say, I'm one of those people. And this was the experience that I had. And understand that there are real people attached to those experiences and real people attached to those decisions. And if you had noticed by now, I'm not one to hold my tongue. I'm not one. I don't know where I got this boldness from, but God decided I was going to be bold. So I'm just bold. And I'm going to say what needs to be said to make sure that all of those people that I spoke about before are represented at that table.
Yeah, we went to an employee luncheon in Frederick, and I saw how much love and care and how people were with your team. And just sitting back and watching, it was very heartwarming to see a company that was that caring.
Thank you.
And how the team got together and they laughed together, the awards ceremony for them. So kudos to you guys
for that
environment. Because it's one thing you pick up right away.
Yeah.
You always, you go to a company party, somebody's over by themselves, but everybody was together.
Yeah.
Hanging out, even though you had better bowling numbers than I did. Sorry, bro. We ain't gonna talk about that. The bowling
numbers. I thought you came to show off. But.
It was a bad day. It was a bad day, but it was lovely to see that. Mm-hmm. And I thought that to me, and I was thankful to be a part of that and see how the background, what you guys really do. It helped me shape for this interview to see how you guys roll behind the scenes. So thank you for me being a part of that.
Absolutely.
Now, being an investor, tell us about that. I mean, you're a big time investor, investments. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that. How'd you get into that?
Well, I like to say real estate for me. Okay. I think that you guys, having housing instability changes how you view things. Mm-hmm. And so I always thought when my mother bought a house and I saw the power that comes with owning a home, and it was a small rural house in Northeast Baltimore, and I retired my mother and I bought that house from her because I said, that's our house still.
Right.
And so when you don't own property, in America, you own nothing.
Mm.
And it's so important. There's a good book about this. It's called The Color of Law. And it talks about redlining, particularly in Baltimore, and how we have such an economic deficit because Black people were not allowed to participate in home buying processes and home buying programs. So after World War II, our great-grandparents or grandparents didn't get a GI Bill, and they couldn't utilize that and leverage that to be able to send their children and grandchildren to college and all of those things. So many things that are tied to property and ownership and paying your taxes that's involved that we don't get to participate in because we don't own land. And my husband and I remember not our first home, but our second home, when we went to buy it, the sellers had a very particular number in mind, and it was because they'd taken out mortgages and loans against the value of the house to pay for their children to go to college. And so they needed to make sure that they hit that number so that they were able to retire and downsize and get a smaller house. But I thought about that. They've been able to leverage that land to pay for their children's education and all of their children. Because when you're buying a house from people, sometimes you get a chance to talk to them and understand a little bit about their lives. All of their children were executives. And their children were executives in a media company that the father was an executive in. So I just want you to understand the privilege on all of those levels. The privilege is, you know, I can utilize this land, this mortgage, this money that we have here, this house is literally sitting here like a bank for us. I can use this little bank that we have, and I can pay for all five of my children to go to college. And then I can leverage the privilege that I have as an executive in a media company to bring them on to the media company all throughout the country. And now my children are executives. So I have established a way for them to become educated, and I can put them in positions where they can make even more money and leverage for my grandchildren. We don't have that option a lot of times because we don't own property. So that really stuck with me. And so when we started being successful, my husband is in real estate. He a couple of places around your studio, he's developed those too. We just decided we were going to invest in land. And he, like a lot of he loves to flip. So he likes to, you know, he has a creative flow to him too. My husband is very, he's very analytical. So he likes to crunch the numbers, and he's very creative in a lot of ways too. So he wants to design things in a certain way too. He's also very practical, so he can pick out the perfect location for things. So all of these wonderful things he has in here makes him a great speculator. And so, we decided to get into real estate because I have a tremendous love for this city. I hate the blight that we have in this city. And I just figure, I think you can always take something that other people find ugly and make it beautiful. And so that's what we've begun to do together. Now, that's primarily him. I'm one of those people. I was like, oh, yeah, pick out. Like, how about this area? How about that? But my husband is really good about, I always say Jada can come up with the big idea. But my husband, is going to give you the details and the facts that you need to support that idea. And so he does that. And he does it so well and so seamlessly.
I love it. You guys are doing it together, though. That's a great part.
We do everything together. That's a great part. Our home office, we have desks side by side. And people are like, don't you ever get sick of each other? We just kind of flow. Right. It's not like we never argue or anything like that. You know what I mean? That's not true. But my husband and I are partners in every sense of the word. And so we work together very seamlessly. And I can say the same thing. I say it for Chris, my husband, and Chris Simon as well, too. They're very good about respecting a woman's opinion because women are easily dismissed in business. And I think I make it really clear. I'm not nobody's little wife. I don't think I got it in me. You know what I mean? I'm my husband's wife, but I'm not shrinking violet. I'm not, you know, I don't know what to tell you. She got a voice. God gave her one. She going to use it. Right. You understand what I'm saying? Right. And so both of them are very, very good about respecting my judgment, what I have to say, and respecting me as a leader in my own right. So that's always made it so much easier for me to be able to bloom and to go out here and do those things that I do.
I noticed that in your company, you guys have a lot of powerful women in powerful positions. And I asked Chris this question. I'm going to ask you, was that on purpose?
Nobody works harder and with more passion. And this isn't a slight to men, but especially in our field, a lot of men, they get the degree and they're like, oh, I want to go in business for myself, which is great. But somebody's got to hold those businesses up. You know, not everybody wants to be an entrepreneur. Some people just have a great deal of passion and don't mind working and just want the job to get done and get done right. And we have a group of women on our staff who want the job to get done, and they want it to get done right. And I always tell people, this is not catch a check territory, because I'm going to work hard. You got to outwork me. So we all got to work hard. You understand? And they get it done.
I love that. Mm-hmm. I love that. And what are any other investments or things recently you want to talk about today?
Well, besides the real estate, my husband and I, we're also investors for Outcrowd. Outcrowd Restaurant Group, and we have a little restaurant in Harvard East called Black Swan that we opened up in 2001 during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I would like to say for the record that I'm a reluctant partner. I was a reluctant partner in this. And so our business partner, Chris Simon, came up with the idea of Black Swan, and we talked about it because I'd heard another person that I went to high school with on Facebook, and she was talking about opening up a restaurant and just this concept that I thought was amazing. And so Chris Simon and I, he was talking about this as well too. He'd always said he wanted to have like a restaurant, a lounge, a space for us. And so we began to have those conversations. I think his wife came up with the name Black Swan, or he did, or something. I always get confused about that part of it. But anyway, we decided to partner together and do Black Swan. And the concept is all his idea. Mm-hmm. My one contributing factor to the concept of Black Swan was the chicken box, because we're from Baltimore.
And it is a delicious chicken box.
Listen, they were trying to get too elevated, and I was like, yo, we're from Baltimore. We got to represent. You got to have a chicken box on the menu. They tried to fight me on it.
Did you know that mm-hmm. when we did a Vice TV show there, mm-hmm. when we taped, that's what I got.
You have to be.
From national TV, everybody's like, people are like, yeah, hot sauce, ketchup. I'm like, y'all just don't know. Y'all, it's a Baltimore way.
It's a Baltimore thing.
Okay.
And I'm, like I said, I'm always very proud of where we come from. And I feel like, you know, you got to let people know. Right. So if people coming from out of town, they got to know that this is a thing here. And so we decided to, like all things, I put it in prayer. And I happened to go to church during the pandemic, and I prayed, and I was like, God, if you think that this restaurant is the thing that we should do, then I'm going to go with it.
During the pandemic, too.
During the pandemic. And I think I failed to mention that I was a waitress from the time that I was 14 till I was 16, and I met my husband at a restaurant, so we were kind of like finished with restaurants.
Right.
He had actually gotten out of the restaurant business to go into real estate.
Mm.
And so I got a phone call from Chris. When I got to my car, he was like, I just got this space. It's in Harbor East. And dad, I said, well, I guess that's it, God, so we're going to do it. And we have been full. Ever since then, we opened up. They had lifted the capacity. The city of Baltimore had lifted the capacity for dining from, I think it was 40-50% to 100%. We were booked solid for months, and it's been thriving ever since.
It's hard to get in there.
I know.
It's hard to get in there.
Well, so much so that now yesterday we had our ribbon cutting for our new restaurant, Prim and Proper. So again, that's the Outcrowd Restaurant Group. And
so what made you go for two? What made you want to do two?
Because if you did it once and it was good, why not do it again? Or you can say I'm glutton for punishment. One or two, I don't know. But no, but again, I believe in expansion, and it's partnership. So it's not just us. It's also, I think you've heard of Poppy Cuisine before. They're mm-hmm. also a restaurant in Baltimore. So some of the owners for Poppy Cuisine and the Outcrowd Restaurant Group, we've gotten together. Again, partnerships make you stronger. And so we came together for this beautiful concept called Prim and Proper. And it's just absolutely, when I talk about a renaissance in Baltimore, I think I was telling Chris and Chris this, my husband Chris and then Chris Simon, this our business partner, about 5 years ago, that there's going to be a renaissance in Baltimore. And they were like, oh, yeah, Jada, I know, you want us to invest in da-da-da-da in real estate. And it was always a plan to do that. So I don't want to act like they were poo-pooing me, because that's not it. But I just kept saying, like, I could just feel it in the air. There's going to be this renaissance in Baltimore. And all of that to say, fast forward, I walked into the space of Prim and Proper, and I said, oh, it's here. The renaissance is here. Because when you go in there, it's almost like it feels like a throwback to a different point in time.
It does. Yeah. It's a vibe. I mean, mm-hmm. I didn't know what to expect mm-hmm. when I went, and I was kind of like, oh, this is different.
Yeah.
It's a different vibe.
Yeah.
The food is delicious.
Yeah. Thank you.
The vibe, I think what blew me away was just and I was telling this off camera, people are dressed up looking beautiful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it reminded me of my parents looking at their pictures of everybody dressed up to the tens. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we've lost that.
Yeah.
I remember always seeing Black people looking good, mm-hmm. like to the tens.
Yeah.
And when I went into the Prim and Proper that night, I felt like what my mom and dad always talked about.
Yeah.
And it was like, wow. And people were like, how can you explain? I'm like, I can't. I was like, I can't explain what I just witnessed and what I was mm-hmm. a part of. But I felt like I wasn't in Baltimore.
Yeah.
And it was like, wow. And I was like, and then my friend was like, they had a dress code? I'm like, I said, I sure as hope the hell they have a dress code. Because that's what it's all mm-hmm. about. I want to be somewhere like that, where I'm wearing a suit and tie and looking sharp. And where, you know, my friends are looking great. We can sit back and have an elegant night.
Yeah.
That's when you don't have fine dining in Baltimore, that's mm-hmm. Black owned.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so you guys have opened that door for us. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm very excited to be a part of it. Janelle, one of our business partners, she came up with the concept of prim and proper. And when the way she explained it, she's a sommelier. And the way she explained it, I absolutely fell in love. And the first thing that came to mind was the porters. There was a group of porters, and I think it was the 1930s. They were a group of black porters, and they dressed sharp, and they were so proud of their jobs, mm-hmm. and they had elegant manners. And that was the first thing that I thought of. Mm. And I said, that needs to be the feel here. But she'd already had the concept and hit it on the head. But see, again, that's why partnerships are so important, because how could we get that all done if we didn't all agree to walk away together? Mm. You can do far more if you agree to focus on many things. So a lot of the things that I'm talking about that we do in partnerships.
I love that.
And so I can focus on what I'm focusing on and give comment and consult, and you can focus on the thing that's your main interest and give me comment and consult. We can do those things and pool our resources and be able to do many things at once without your full time and attention being put into it, because everyone has an expertise.
So the $1 million question is, what's next for you, Michelle? You are a powerhouse. What's next for you?
So right now, my husband and I, I would just say this, we are working really hard to do real estate development and just some ground up real estate development in West Baltimore.
Great.
Because there's so much blight in West Baltimore, and we went to Coppin and they're building up that area so much, and it's beautiful around there because they're starting to build it up. And so we're committed to that area, and we've purchased land there and we're ready to build. And so we're working on that. But you know, it's so funny because you see a building go up and you're like, oh, this happened overnight. You don't know all of the groundwork.
No, there's a lot
honey,
more.
Honey, woo, it's work it's behind little... getting those things done. And so that is the goal. The goal is to own half of Baltimore.
I know.
And to put land ownership in other people's hands in Baltimore as well. To make Baltimore shine, for people to see how beautiful it is and to see it the way that I see it. I always say, like, Baltimore's like having an ugly baby. Like, you're the only person who thinks it's beautiful. Like, oh my gosh. You're like, don't you see my baby? And people are like, ooh. Yikes.
I love it. You know, that's a good analogy. That's a good
not
analogy.
Not that my babies are beautiful. I just want to make that clear, but you know.
I like that analogy. What do you want people to walk away from this episode? What do you want them to walk away from? What we've talked about several things, but what do you really want them to walk away with?
More than anything, that ordinary people can do extraordinary things.
Okay.
And that you need to, I always say this, I read this quote a long time ago, it says, bloom where you're planted. And people always say, aren't you going to leave Baltimore? And I'm like, no. Because I was born here. And I feel like, you know, God placed me in what some people consider one of the worst cities in America so that I can do my part to make it as beautiful as I possibly can. And so that's my purpose, to empower the people here so that they know that no matter how humble your beginnings, no matter what your start is, that you can do something beautiful too.
I love that. But we're not letting you get off the hook.
Okay.
We got to speed around.
Okay.
We just be all right. So you're a Baltimore person. Uh-huh. All right.
Okay.
Snowball or ice cream?
Ooh. I gotta get a snowball right around the corner from here.
You already know. Yeah. All right. At custard?
Yep.
Okay. Got
marshmallow if I'm feeling real froggy.
Gotta ask the question. Crabs or crab cakes?
Crabs. All right. It ain't fun if I'm not picking it.
Okay. Right. A lot of people like to get the crab.
That's
like
my
crab
husband. Cake. I say it's because you lazy. Because your family from New Jersey. You don't want to take the time.
Hey, I get it. So buffalo wings, flats or drums?
Flats. Come on now. What am I? Savages eat drums.
Okay. So, blue cheese or ranch?
Ranch.
Okay. Ranch.
Ranch? Ranch. I'm
okay.
A ranch
all right. All right. All right. Are you a Honey Old Bay person for wings?
Ooh.
Or buffalo?
I prefer a Honey Old Bay. I like a... But I'm from everything Old Bay.
Obey on everything. If we jumped in your car right now, what would the first song pop on?
It would probably be a podcast.
Okay, you podcasting. Even better. Hey, that's even better.
I gotta learn everything I'm doing. I need to learn. I have to absorb, as between podcasts and books, I try to absorb as much information as I possibly can at all times. And if I'm not learning, I don't want
to
do it.
It's funny because that's what I listen to in my car. I do listen to podcasts all the time. I watch news, but I listen to a lot of different podcasts. I like to listen to different perspectives and understand a lot of other things. Like, oh, what's this? What's going on in the world?
Right.
Okay, let me understand a little bit more about this. So
yeah.
That's interesting. You listen to podcasts. And Super Bowl. What was you watched Super Bowl? What was your favorite halftime performance?
Oh, I'm looking forward to seeing Usher. If he does anything like he did in Vegas,
Did you see Vegas show?
I was first front row at the Vegas show.
It was like
front
that?
Front row. I'm telling you, I got roller skate dust on my head because I was that close.
I love that. I love that. Well, thank you so much for your time. I know you're a busy person. I'm glad we finally made it happen. I'm excited to celebrate what you have going on. And thank you so much. And keep on doing what you're going to do. Because I told him, I said, we got to do a show up in Prairie and Prop on the second floor.
Okay.
I think we got to do a live one with a cool audience. I think that'd be kind of cool.
Yeah.
Just a really tall, you get you and Chris actually on stage.
Yes.
And do really have like a conversation just about everything. I think that'd be kind of cool.
That's always an interesting conversation with me and Chris in the room together.
Yeah, behind the scenes, I think that'd be really cool. But thank you so much for what you've done for Baltimore. Your love and passion has shown through. And thank you for just tugging us through the stories of your life, of how you got to where you got. And I love how you said collaboration. You know, one thing I've taken away is going back to tell people money's not everything. You got to figure out, yeah, you might want this $100, but I put you in a room with somebody that's even more money than you can talk about. And I really like that. I really think people, we get a misconstrued. And I think that's very important. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
And where can people find you? Are you on, if they want to look you up, are you on a social media? Are you anywhere? Can they find you? Where can they find you?
So I'm reluctantly on social media.
Oh, reluctantly. Okay.
It's meet_JadaMcCray. On IG.
And can they find you at your business at all? Or are you on websites? Okay. Yeah.
Okay. It's btstservices.com. It's joshuahomecdc.com. BlackSwan.com. And I think it's eatblackswan.com. I'm sorry. And I'm sure we have one for Prim and Proper as well.
Okay.
Well, I'm easy to find.
Okay. Folks, thank you so much. Love, peace. We're out.